This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. For a lot of people, North Dakota's last oil boom became a beckoning call of the wild. Mostly men from around the country, even the world, flocked to the Bakken to make fast money from the mineral-rich earth. But today, you'll hear from someone who was seeking something more. Singer, songwriter, playwright, and author, Michael Patrick F. Smith. His debut book is out today from Penguin Random House. It's called The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. Prairie Public's Eric Dethridge, who knows the author from their days in Maryland, hosts this conversation.
So besides the promise of quick cash, what was it that brought you to Williston? What was it, 2013?
Yeah, it was in 2013. And, you know, a good amount of it was sort of believing the media hype around the oil boom and thinking that I would make a lot of money very quickly. So that was a major, that was one of the major reasons that I made the move. Also, I guess I was just having some personal things in my life. You know, my life was a little bit upside down, and I was looking to make a kind of a clean break or make some kind of break to what I was experiencing at the time when I was living in, I moved out from Brooklyn, New York. There's not two places that are quite so far apart as Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and Williston, North Dakota. So it was a big change.
Well, did you plan from the outset to write a book, or did that just sort of happen organically or accidentally while you were working out there?
I had it, did have it in the back of my head. I've always written, but I'd never written a book. I'd always written plays mostly and written music. And it was kind of in the back of my head. I couldn't tell, honestly, at the time if it was something that I was just sort of saying to my more artistic friends so that they would understand it. You know, part of it was that. I mean, I grew up in a rural area in central Maryland. I grew up on a kind of dysfunctional farm out there. And so part of my reason was, you know, I'd lived in cities ever since I was 18, 19, and I just felt like I wanted to reconnect, you know, with rural America and with kind of what the way that I'd grown up with.
What kind of jobs did you wind up getting out there? I mean, you think of oil rig work. There's a lot of things you could be doing with that. But what did you wind up doing? What was your position?
So I became what's called a swamper for a rig moving company. So with an oil rig, basically it sits in one place and it drills for oil for about 2.5 months on average. And then a trucking company I worked for, we'd show up with specialized trucks, bed trucks and gin trucks and cranes. And it would be our job to pull the oil rigs apart, load them onto big rigs, move them to another location, and put them together. So it's kind of like within a series of a few days, you are taking apart a skyscraper and putting it back together. And I was, as a swamper, I was the feet on the ground for the truck drivers and the crane operators. So I was doing a lot of rigging, a lot of throwing chains and hooks.
And I can say this because we know each other, and I say it with affection, that you're not the brawniest of guys, at least not when you got there. So physically, you know, describe how demanding the job was and how you fit into it.
I mean, it was the hardest work I've ever done in my life, and I was I was woefully out of shape. I'm not a big guy to begin with. But, you know, the job is real demanding. It's a 14-hour day, and you're out in the sun, the rain, the sleet, or the snow. It's all physical labor.
Yeah, and not a whole lot of downtime. You didn't have that much time to do some pursuits of pleasure, but being a singer-songwriter, you did take in a gig and do a little performing yourself. It was in Watford City. Describe that experience for us and what it made you want and miss.
Yeah, that was one of the nicest moments I had the first summer that I got to North Dakota. I went down and joined some musicians in Watford City at the band shell down there. You know, it was just a great kind of casual thing of hanging out and playing some songs. The great thing about music and about the guitar is that it's sort of like, you know, it's portable. And having a guitar is kind of like having a home in a case. You know, you can go anywhere and you'll meet other musicians. I've got great friends who are musicians who I've literally just only, the only thing I've really said to them is maybe like, what's the change at the bridge? You know, it's kind of like, it's kind of got its
spoken
own
language.
Yeah. It's got its own language. And so I had a great time. There's some great players down there, and, it just, you know, it opened, it's just such a nice feeling, you know, with the work. I think that was only a couple of weeks before I started in the oil field. And once you're doing oil field work, it's really hard to have the energy to do anything besides work. So that was the only time I really did much playing.
Well, in the book, there's a scene where you describe starting a little jam of No Woman, No Cry in the flop house where you were staying. And you did, I would say almost squalid conditions in this house with just one on top of the other. You're sleeping in the living room with so many people, and it's quite a motley crew and not so much fun living there. But I was intrigued by a couple of Jamaican gentlemen who were there that you banged out No Woman, No Cry with. And you were certainly drawn to them, or at least his presence comforted you in a way. Describe the diversity that you left behind in Brooklyn and the homogeneity that you experienced and even the racism that you witnessed while in the Bakken.
You know, I was coming from New York. I'd lived in for a while in Sunset Park, which I'm pretty sure is like one of the most diverse neighborhoods on earth. You know, it's just got like everybody is there. And so you walk down the street and you see, you know, you hear a bunch of different languages, you'll see a bunch of different cultures. And it's really vibrant. And it's not that it doesn't have its problems. It certainly does. But, I'd come from that. And then, you know, North Dakota is pretty homogenous. I think that when I arrived was really interesting because, you know, I was an out-of-towner along with a flood of out-of-towners. And I can only imagine sort of like the pressure that puts on you when you're a local. One of the first places I lived was renting a mattress on a floor in a flop house with a bunch of other migrant workers, and they came from all over the country. And then there was a group of Jamaican guys who became my buddies. And then the company I worked with also had hired a lot of Congolese guys. And so, you know, there's sort of this shock, it seemed like, to the system of a place that wasn't used to that kind of a influx of culture, you could say. And I witnessed a lot of racism. And in retrospect, it's not that it was different per se than what I'd encountered in Baltimore City or in New York, but it was more overt. The language was a lot darker than anything I had really been around since I was a kid. And so that was something that I did struggle with.
Yeah, and there's some pivotal moments in the book that sort of describe some of what you're talking about, and that's another undercurrent running through the book that's so interesting. And another one, a very chief one, is military service. That runs throughout the book. Your dad served, your uncle, a hero of yours, he served. Now, you wanted to, too, when you were a kid. You wore a military jacket to school. You were kind of primed and ready for that until your life took a different turn. But what are the parallels that you see between the oil patch and the work there and the military, and how does that relate to your personal experience?
Sure. I was kind of a weird kid in that I was really obsessed with military service and then also fell in love with theater. And I was very torn between these two things. It was a really serious issue for me when I was getting out of high school as to what I was going to do. And I ended up pursuing theater. You know, there are a lot of similarities. I mean, if you're a lot of veterans are drawn to oil field work. I think that there's a certain structure it provides. There's the brotherhood of, you know, working in a male-dominated kind of situation where it's really, really hard work, and you really have to rely on the guys that you're working with. And there's that kind of pride, I think, that you can take in knowing that the job that you do makes the world spin. Another thread that I get into the book, and that's, I think, is incredibly important, is it seemed like every guy I met in the oil field would talk about how his dad had beat him up as a kid. And it was sometimes the first thing that we'd talk about, you know, I'd be like, sit down at the bars and be like, man, my dad whipped my ass. And then somebody across the other side would say, mine too, you know, and you'd end up having these kind of funny, you know, generally funny conversations about it. But there's that cloak a lot of seriousness. And I know that in studies that I'd looked at, it's very, very true that in the American military, you know, when you talk about the PTSD issues that soldiers come home with, a lot of that can be traced to the fact that that they were beat up as kids or abused as kids. And then you join the military and you become kind of re-traumatized.
Yeah, they had PTSD before they even joined, and so they get victimized twice by that, yeah. Well, I'd love it if you could read a passage about that from the book. It's on page 146, and I should say in it you make reference to the new ghost, or I should say now ghost town in Pennsylvania, the site of the first oil well back in 1859 and the subsequent boom town there. Could you go ahead and read that passage for us, Michael?
Sure thing. Ever since Civil War General M.H. Avery, commander of a Union cavalry regiment, rode directly from Lee's surrender at Appomattox to Pitt Hole City to organize an army train of Teamsters, military men have been a constant presence in the oil field. There are many similarities between the jobs. Both are hard. They involve travel to inhospitable places, ridiculously long, physically demanding hours, and a discipline and grit beyond what most men and women are willing to endure. Former CIA Director and U.S. General David Petraeus, on a visit to North Dakota in 2013, would compare the Bakken to a war zone. Soldiers and oil field hands are both indispensable to the functioning of modern society. Arguably, they are drawn from the bottom of society's totem pole, coming from the rougher edges of the American dream, and born into their jobs most often because their dads did it. America fetishizes our armed forces. In my opinion, this makes it easier to discount soldiers as human beings. If we really love them, they'd get better benefits. All that said, the Roughnecks on Sidewinder Canebrake 103 seemed to me like Special Forces Commandos, the gold standard of a certain type of manhood, and I was excited to be around them.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with author, singer, songwriter, and playwright Michael Patrick F. Smith, reading from his new book, The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown out on Penguin Random House today. Now, that's pretty exciting. That's pretty exciting stuff. It's like we talked about this the other day offline. It's like being on a major label.
Yeah. It feels real good. It's amazing to have the institutional support. You know, I've been telling stories in some form or other ever since I was a kid, and it's always been kind of my passion and the direction of my life, you know. But to have some help with it is amazing.
Now, you did describe that most of the guys that you were working with, and you included, had holes in their heart when it came to their dads. Can you share with us your father wound and actually some of the family tragedy that helped you wind up in the Bakken?
You know, I had a dad who was a troubled guy, and he was violent, and he had demons that he just kind of couldn't figure out. He didn't know how to work them out. And when you grow up in that kind of situation, you become real accustomed to things being heightened, to being in a kind of a constant state of alertness. And I think one of the reasons I've been drawn to performing, for instance, is just that the stress of it is real, real comfortable to me. And when I was living in New York before I moved to North Dakota, I was probably the most comfortable I'd ever been in my life. I had a solid job. I was making a good living. I had a great apartment. I had friends. And I just was having more and more of a hard time dealing with it. And I didn't understand why. So I was starting to put myself into just kind of some risky, stupid situations that I talk about in the book. And I've just come to understand that that was one of the things that drew me to doing one of the world's most dangerous jobs.
You're not comfortable with being comfortable, Michael.
Yeah, exactly. It can be very hard when, you know, you've been abused as a kid and even as an adult. I mean, I was in my 30s when I did this. And if you'd have asked me then, I would have said, well, I'm over all that. Yeah, my dad was bad. You know, wasn't so great. He was a tough guy, but I would have told you that I was over it.
I find where you grew up interesting, because I'm from Maryland, as you are, and you mentioned, you know, sort of in more of a rural area. Most people don't think of rural areas in Maryland, but you grew up on kind of a farm, and then in high school, you had a teacher that sort of dramatically changed your life and got you into the theater. Yeah, talk about the early interest in the stage and just, you know, how one male figure can kind of set you in the right direction.
Yeah, I grew up in, you know, in central Maryland in this small kind of gnarly farm that was down in this valley. It was an old tobacco farm. The house that I lived in was a, you know, had been built just after the Civil War. It was an old rickety farmhouse, and sometimes we didn't have heat or hot water or anything like that. Not all the time, but it was almost like growing up in kind of like a different time period than my peers, you know. And so when I entered high school, I took a drama class, which was primarily really I was just trying to have a class with no homework, you know. But I ended up with a teacher. The guy who taught the class was also the baseball coach. And his name's Carl. He's still I consider him a dear friend. And he was, you know, growing up with a rough dad. And my dad was always punching the wall and breaking the furniture and raging around, and to grow up and to kind of meet a guy who was, you know, who was a masculine guy, but was also sensitive and kind of unafraid of talking about his feelings and willing to dive into kind of the emotional aspect of things was just completely new to me, you know, and to see, to kind of start to learn that there's an inner toughness that comes with that kind of masculinity. That is often a lot stronger than a lot of the phony tough guys that you meet out there. So he was really showed me like a different way. And then, you know, I'd grown up kind of running around the woods and just playing pretend by myself all the time. So I think that when I was given a script to a play and just started saying the words, it was real easy for me to just kind of immediately transport myself into the scene and just kind of find a way to be myself. I think a lot of times when people talk about acting, it's this idea that you kind of become somebody else or whatever. For me, I was so damn uncomfortable. I was such a nerd and so scared of everything that when I had the, you know, this opportunity within the confines and the safety of a theater to express myself, I mean, it was the first time I ever felt like myself.
Well, and you put yourself out there, you transported yourself to Dust Bowl, Oklahoma, but when you staged a play about Woody Guthrie, you chatted up, there's a passage in the book about a chat with Pete Seeger that I just found fascinating and very revealing, and you have folk musician heroes like, of course, Woody, and especially Ramblin' Jack Elliott. They all found their way into your life and in this book. Talk about how folk music and hard work, how they have intersected in your life.
Yeah, folk music is real important to me, and you know, music in general is important to me. Folk music, I think of as a special kind of thing to itself. You know, I'm a traditionalist, and I love the tradition of folk music and the idea that these songs have sort of traveled through time and have their own life. You know, a song can be like a redwood. You know, it's sort of like some of these tunes that Woody Guthrie adapted, or Pete Seeger and Jack, it's like a river of song, you know, that has lasted hundreds of years at least. We don't know how old some of them are. And so I've always been really drawn to that aspect of it. And then when you look at these guys, I also am somebody who I take inspiration in the people who have come before me, whether they're my great uncle, Captain Bill Boylan, who was a sailor in the Merchant Marines and the Navy, or whether it's, you know, a guy like Woody Guthrie, somebody who I never met, or somebody like Teddy Roosevelt, you know, who I just can't read enough about Teddy Roosevelt. But sort of finding these guys that have, you know, that live certain types of lives and keeping them in mind as I live my own life, and something that I really came to believe as I was working in the oil field was just the value of hard work. And it intersects with folk music in the way that just the tradition and just the ability to do things with our hands, the ability to have practical, having practical knowledge, having practical skills. It's something that is getting lost and has become so devalued in our society that it's really making us all crazy. I mean, you know, not to get too political, but you get on the, you watch the TV and they'll have economists and they'll have all, you know, all these people talking about healthcare or whatever. Show me a nurse. You know what I mean? Like, you all can't get a nurse practitioner on the news to help explain healthcare to people. I don't understand. You know, there's this incredible devaluing of people who know how to do things. And it's a problem, and it's a problem, and it's in, and it's a, it's an area in which our society needs to be reformed because these skills are important.
Well, and there, it seems like there's an entrepreneurial fetish all the time in the media too, and nobody wants to talk to the grunts on the front lines. That's kind of always bugged me.
Right, we're all supposed to be starting our own .coms. You know, like, I've never had any desire to start my own business. It's just never as specifically a computer business. They drive me up a wall.
They're everywhere. They're ubiquitous for sure.
Yeah, and like, meanwhile, if we don't have plumbers, the world stops.
Right, like, as we're finding, you know what I mean? We're finding out because we're staying at home a lot, using the plumbing a lot more.
Yeah. You're not going to call up an economist to have him fix your sink.
Right.
It's funny you mentioned Teddy Roosevelt, and there's also Lewis and Clark. I should say, for North Dakotans who are interested, because we have quite an affection for those guys, East Coast guys that came out here and really kind of, let's say, made a name for themselves. There's a lot of affection and parallels with your journey in the book, too. But I want to talk about the title of the book, getting back to that, The Good Hand. It refers to what you discovered in yourself. You wanted the Bakken to kick your hide. You wanted the work to hurt. And it did, as you described earlier. That pain, the desire to find grace through hard work. Describe that. Describe that sort of grace, that salvation in a way that you found in that pinnacle that you reached of being a good hand.
Yeah, that's a great question. The term "the good hand" is it's oil field slang, which kind of comes from a cowboy slang. But when you start out in the oil field, you're a worm, or you're a greenhorn, is the nice way of putting it. And then basically, if you become a good worker, you become a hand. You can make a hand, and kind of the highest level of achievement in the very understated culture of the oil field is for someone to become a good hand. So I found myself really enamored with the language around it. And also, to be a good hand is aspirational to me. You know, it's just a reminder of, like, I can do better. Like, what's the best that I can do in any given situation? I think of it as almost a spiritual calling.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Eric Deatherage, joined by Michael Patrick F. Smith, who is out with his first book, The Good Hand, a Memoir of Work, Brotherhood, and Transformation in an American Boomtown. And Mike, I'd love it if you could read another passage for us. This one comes from page 272 that answers some questions.
Why did you go to North Dakota, Michael? Because if life is suffering, it must be worth suffering. Because if life is to have any meaning, I need to take responsibility for it. And if life is suffering, and it is, then I need to take responsibility for that suffering too, don't I? Why doesn't take you out to lunch for a cheeseburger with all the fixings just how you like it? It doesn't salt the rim on your margarita or rub lotion on your hands and ask you how your day's been. Like life, why hurts? The scars in the land on which I toil, the scars in the body in which I work, the scars across my very soul, the father wound in my heart, the grief for my sister running like a gully through the whole length of my very life. I must be responsible for all of it. I can't go on. I'll go on.
That's author, playwright, and musician Michael Patrick F. Smith reading from his debut novel, The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. He'll be back in the second half of the show to talk about two of the book's most memorable characters and how he views climate change after his experience working in the Bakken. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A House committee has rejected a proposed constitutional measure to legalize recreational marijuana. The measure was proposed by Democratic State Representative Marvin Nelson of Rolla. The measure would legalize marijuana for anyone over the age of 21, and the individuals could grow their own. It also would have imposed a tax on it to be used for drug education and treatment. Nelson told the House Judiciary Committee,
"The goal is to bring the whole thing above board, get rid of criminal activity, quit ruining people's lives over things that are really rather minor.
The committee voted to remove the taxation section, then voted 10-2 for a do not pass. Earlier, the committee voted 8-4 for a do pass on the bill to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana and possession of marijuana paraphernalia. The measure's main sponsor, Fargo Republican Representative Shannon Rose Jones, told the committee anyone in possession of less than an ounce of marijuana would be guilty of a non-criminal offense, punishable by a $50 fine.
We don't want to create criminal records that are going to affect people into the future for possessing small quantities of marijuana or marijuana paraphernalia. What we've recognized is this affects people's ability to find jobs, housing, etc. in the future, affects their ability to be successful.
Roars Jones says 1 ounce of marijuana would be roughly equivalent to the tobacco content of one pack of cigarettes. The North Dakota House has rejected a bill that would allow physician-assisted suicide for people who suffer from a terminal illness. Mandan Republican Representative Karen Rohr urged a no vote.
Life is sacred from conception to natural death. Dying patients should receive loving care, including psychological care, spiritual care, and appropriate remedies for pain and other symptoms so that they can live life with dignity until the time of natural death.
The bill's sponsor, Fargo Democratic Representative Pamela Anderson, argued that it should be a choice by someone diagnosed with a terminal illness.
So this bill is a basic idea that terminally ill people, not government, politicians or their ideology, or religious leaders and their dogma, should make end-of-life decisions and determine how much pain and suffering they should have to endure.
The measure failed on an 85-9 vote. And the frigid weather that has hampered the midsection of the U.S. continues to pose problems.
About 9:20, 9:25 this morning, we received a phone call from our system operator, which is Western Area Power / Southwest Power Pool, that we needed to commence rolling blackouts in Moorhead starting 30 minutes after that phone call.
Travis Schmidt is general manager with Moorhead Public Service. He says the first rolling blackout was the only one needed, and after 30 minutes, power was fully restored. In all, Schmidt says 9,800 customers were impacted by the blackout. Schmidt says the rolling blackouts have been suspended until further notice. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support is provided by Otter Tail Power Company, providing safe, reliable, and affordable electricity for more than 100 years, while balancing community, economic, and environmental commitments, always.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. If you're just joining us, we're featuring a conversation with author and musician Michael Patrick F. Smith. It's about his debut memoir about working on an oil rig in the Bakken and is titled The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. Here's Prairie Public's Eric Dethridge.
Now, Michael, there are two guys who really stand out in this book as characters, and you can't kind of help but love them or love to hate them and love them again, the Wildebeest and Huck. Can you introduce them to us a little bit here?
Yeah, the Wildebeest was an old school gin truck driver, and he'd been raised in the oil field. His dad was a gin truck driver, and he'd been raised in company housing. I think in the book I say if I ask you to draw a picture of a truck driver, you would draw the Wildebeest. He was just the toughest, meanest, most ornery dude that I've ever met. He really gave me hell. I started out, you know, I wasn't very good. I didn't know how to do the job. And the Beast was given the task of training me up. And he rode me. He made my life really, really, really difficult. But we ended up kind of coming to an understanding with each other. It became a relationship that I really valued, you know, and he became somebody I really cared about and counted on. And I know that he got a kick out of me. He passed away a few years ago, but I remember, you know, he wasn't one to give too many compliments. And I remember Huck telling me that the Wildebeest had said to him, "That Mikey, he's all heart," you know. And I heard that, and I thought, all right, well, we're cool.
Not a bad thing to say.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, he sort of took the place of my father in like a symbolic way. Huck was a dude who, he had just turned 21 the day I started in the oil field, and I was, I think, 36 or 37. And Huck is just a big, huge, towering dude, funny kid. We became friends pretty quickly and became real, really, really, really close. But he was somebody who, you know, he had the ability of kind of your stereotypical kind of oil field trash. You know, he got a kick out of being perceived that way. And he had the ability to explain and to tell stories and to be funny in just the certain way that I always found it was almost as if he was speaking for everybody. You know, he kind of fashioned himself into this funny character. And he was just a big, lovable goofball. But, you know, drinking was real bad for him. And he got in a lot of fights and a lot of trouble with the law.
Yeah, lots of descriptions of both those gentlemen in the book. Now, you said something earlier that would probably surprise a lot of people. New York City and Williston are kind of similar places. How so, Michael?
Yeah. Well, you know, everyone in New York is super aware of the fact that they're in New York, you know. And I found it with the oil boom. Everybody was just like, it's an oil boom, don't you know? So there's those two kind of like poles. And I also found that New York is this kind of bastion of the melting pot in the way that we perceive it. I mean, it was built on gang violence and these kind of like warring factions and a lot of racial strife. And when I was in Williston with so many newcomers and out-of-towners moving into this place, you had all this kind of friction. You know, it had this historic parallel with New York City. I mean, the other thing is that the work that's done in Williston, the work that's done in the oil fields, the benefits of that work goes out to the coasts in this country. So in New York City, you're really living on the backs of oil field guys in the middle of North Dakota.
So there's this epiphany of sorts where you're out on the town in New York City. I love this passage. It's kind of a long passage, but I love it if you could read this one. It's page 306.
Sure thing. My friends and I leave the theater and land back onto the streets. I'm with a married duo of documentary filmmakers, a red-bearded guitar player from Georgia and his girlfriend, a yoga instructor, my best friend in New York, a commercial voiceover actor, and his wife, a life coach, and my date, a creative director at a fashion company with a side hustle in rock and roll. We make up a real New York gaggle. We're on our way to hook up with a journalist I'd met when he interviewed me about a play I'd written, and his best friend, a surfer banjo player, who last time I saw him was living in his van. Cabs burning fuel stream past. Electric street lamps flicker through the coil of synthetic rubber wiring. The giant screens of Times Square advertise the world's riches. Cotton polyester blends, food wrapped in plastic, music delivered through plastic earbuds. We escape the lights down into the subway, board and ride through the petroleum tube, back to the street and into a crowded bar. I notice the tabletop varnish made from petroleum derivatives, our glasses forged in oil, the fake leather seats petrol made. We scan the laminated menus and order seafood caught on diesel-powered boats, stored in freezers, shipped in trucks, and brought to our tables by waitresses in slinky clothes. Only oil could make them coil so tightly around those bodies. And we swallow it, suck it, chew it, and devour it all. Delicious, man-extracted, life-granting, world-destroying black gold.
Hmm. Now, you say this book is also a piece of journalism. What kind of research went into this book, and how has working with fossil fuels changed your perspective on, well, climate change?
You know, the book is kind of a mashup of, like, a memoir and then reporting and sort of the stories of... I try to keep the focus on the guys that I work with because that, for me, is the most important part of the story. But I got into the history, and then, you know, the reporting was reading lots and lots and lots of articles and just kind of condensing what I thought were the important parts and putting it throughout the book. The reality of our fossil fuel dependency, the way that I see it, is oil is in every single thing that we have. So it's in the paint on our walls, the finish on your table. It's not just used for transportation, though that's obviously kind of the biggest part of it, but it's also in our food. Our fertilizer generally contains carbon that we would not have if we weren't using fossil fuels. It's also in all of our medicine. The ink in my book is made from petroleum derivatives. So just realizing that it's in everything, to me, was a big awakening. And when it comes to global warming, the way that I view it, look, there's the political side of it, and that needs to be figured out. I personally think we need, you know, some big federal policies to address it. There are people who would disagree with me. What I'm coming to more and more is that our consumption is the problem, and it's the one thing that I have control over. I don't have very much control over who the president is, but I do control kind of how much garbage, how much plastic, how much junk I put in my own life. And I think that there's a much more meaningful life that we can all find outside of this kind of consumer grind, and a life that gets back to thrift as a value, that gets back to stewardship of the land as a value, and gets back to sticking our dirt in the soil in a way that I think is what we need as a society, to sort of get us away from the negative aspects of fossil fuels, because oil is a precious, almost like magical thing. And we want to be able to use it in the ways that we need to use it. But in ways that we don't need it, I think it seems obvious to me that we need to transition to just better ways, cleaner ways to do anything. I don't like it when my room is a mess, you know. And I don't like it full of junk and full of stuff that I'm not using. It makes me feel crazy. So I just feel like the earth is the same thing.
What did you learn as far as living in Williston and the effects of the boom, and imagining what life will be like when the boom was over?
One of the more telling conversations I had with the wildebeest, I'd asked him what he did after the boom busted in the 80s, and he said, I did a lot of poaching, which, you know, was startling to me, because I think that if you're literally talking about getting past using oil as a resource, then you are actually talking about pre-industrial society. And you're talking about a world where skills like hunting and fishing and growing your own food are the predominantly most important skills. And I just feel that educating our children in those kind of ways is incredibly important, you know. And it's an irony to me that it's a little bit of a generalization, but I'd say a lot of my buddies who don't care about global warming or don't believe in it are folks who tend to live lives that have kind of a much smaller carbon imprint and that they're much more in nature, whereas a lot of my friends who live in the cities are so reliant on petroleum and gasoline for every single thing that they do and all of their hobbies, that they're the ones who are like, can't go to sleep at night because they feel like the world's on fire.
Oh, that is ironic. So you probably wouldn't tell your friends in Williston that they are the greenest people you know.
Yeah, suckers.
And your friends back east that they're the biggest wasters you know.
And I think it is important that we start, you know, that it's true. And that's colloquial. That's kind of what I'm seeing as a funny thing.
Well, also what was funny, too, you went out to Williston and your asthma that you feared would be triggered by working in such an industrial environment, it actually got a bit better.
Yeah, it did. And I think, yeah, I've had asthma since I was a kid. And when I was in North Dakota, it all but disappeared. It made me think about the pollution in New York and in Baltimore, where I'd spent much of my life, and just the climate, you know, the big sky country and the dry air of North Dakota.
Well, I love it. That's a lure for me, the air, the sun dogs. And there's a lot of kind of lyricism and poetry in a way in your description of North Dakota and the land. There's a certain romance to it. What is it about North Dakota that you took away, and what is that sort of natural landscape that makes you feel so poetic?
Yeah, I was blessed in coming to North Dakota when I did, and getting to see the state and learn the state through a traveler's eyes. You know, when you're from a place, you don't always see it as clearly. And so I felt like as an outsider coming in, I was able to really connect with it. And then I didn't feel like an outsider when I left. And for me, it's just the scope and the size of the sky and the landscape. There's just something that's so powerful about it. It's a place where nature, I think, puts man in its place. In a city, you can feel like man is God. Like, man's figured all this stuff out. In North Dakota, it still feels like the weather might just kill you at any given moment.
Well, or you know, there's a passage where you're writing about you're walking around Lake Sakakawea and like some buzzards or something are circling. You're like, it must be a carcass around here somewhere. But then you realize, no, it's me. They're circling me.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Nature rules.
Yeah, and I feel like that's a great reminder for humans. That's the thinness of our existence, I think, you can walk with in a real beautiful way. And I'll also say, man, I mean, those cold mornings, working in the oil field in January is some crazy stuff, but I saw more sunrises than I probably have ever seen in my life, and the North Dakota sunrises are just some of the most beautiful images that I will take with me for the rest of my life. I love the state of North Dakota. I'm really, really couldn't say enough about it.
I feel that too. Now, Michael, from your experience, working with these fellow transient workers, these migrants who some of whom became your best friends and even really blood brothers, how do you see the role of labor in America? You know, when there's so much automation and when whole industries have been phased out or outsourced, and now with the pandemic, there's lots of talk about who is an essential worker. What do you see the role is for men like the ones you met?
I mean, that's a hard one to answer, you know. A lot of the guys that I met who weren't locals were guys who basically follow around, either had come from the silver mining towns of like Elko, Nevada, or had come from Texas where they were working the oil fields there. And it's just a hard lifestyle. It's a hard way to work. It's hard to come up with any concrete answer to such a big question. I feel like as a society, we have to get back to the value of work and the value of meaningful lives over a senseless worship of money. If you just want more money and for somebody, then automation is the way to go. Somebody's going to get a lot more money. They're going to save a lot of money. Right. And they're going to have a lot more money. I don't know who these people are. I'm generally not friends with them. I read about them sometimes in the paper. For me, that's not something that I value. So I value people I know having good jobs and doing work that is actually essential. And I think that, you know, the talk of the essential workers is important. And one would hope it would lead to a shift in our thinking, because who are essentials? Carpenters are essential. Construction workers, plumbers, HVAC people are essential. Nurses, doctors are essential. I also believe that actors and musicians are essential. We'd be going nuts if we didn't have Netflix right now, you know. And it's easy to kind of think that most actors are kind of, you know, idiots. And I won't necessarily disagree 100%, but there's still like, getting back to the values around it, like good storytelling is something that we all love and we all need, and that's why we listen to music and that's why we watch TV shows, you know.
All right, so shameless self-promotion for Prairie Public. When you were out in the Bakken working, who were you listening to on the radio?
I was listening to, I called Mike Olson because I was listening to Prairie Public quite a bit. And it expanded my musical pace for sure. So I know that Charlie Parr was somebody the first time I heard him when I was in New York. Fred Eaglesmith was another guy that I was listening to a lot while I was there. Lucinda Williams' first record was on repeat.
Final question for you, Michael. What do you hope that people in North Dakota who read your book take away from it?
I hope people are proud of it. I hope that, you know, there's not, for people like me and people who have, you know, worked tough jobs and done, you know, I'm not like a journalist guy who went to Yale and then decided to study people, you know? So for me, I hope that people read it and that they read about the work, that they identify about the work, and that it makes them feel proud. And I also hope that, you know, for certain people, because I've kind of lived a life that has straddled a few different worlds, from like New York theater to the oil field, that maybe it also gives us a little perspective. It gives people a little perspective on people that right now we're in a divided country. It just gives a little bit of perspective and a little bit of empathy towards towards people who aren't like you, you know, who aren't like you, and that maybe it opens people up in a little bit way to just being a little kinder.
Lord knows we could all use a little bit more of that in this world today. The debut memoir from Michael Patrick F. Smith, out on Penguin Random House today, is called The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. Michael, big congrats on this. This book is full of friendship, hardship, humor, lots of good research and appreciation, as you mentioned, for the people in the land that helped build America. Thank you for joining us on Prairie Public. And whether it's Baltimore or maybe here someday, hopefully we can hoist a couple of glasses in celebration of this book.
Yeah, that sounds great, man. Thanks for having me on.
Eric Dethridge, Prairie Public's operations manager, visiting with Michael Patrick F. Smith, author of The Good Hand. Smith also penned a New York Times op-ed titled, "The First Step is Admitting You Have a Problem, What Working on a North Dakota Oil Patch Taught Me About America's Fossil Fuel Addiction and How to Curb It." You can find out more at thegoodhand.org. The Good Hand is also the name he uses for his music. Let's listen to a song he composed about his time in the oil patch. It's called Truck Stop.
Wash my face in a truck stop bathroom. Brush my teeth, I comb back my hair. I wash my face in a truck stop bathroom. I'm gonna find a good job around here. I can drive a truck, swing a sledgehammer. I can mix a drink, and I know a joke or two. I can drive a truck, swing a sledgehammer. I got two good hands I'm gonna put on to use. The bushes, overturning every stone. When I find work, I will send for you and your daughter. I'm gonna build a home. So I wash my face in a truck stop bathroom, brush my teeth, I comb back my hair. I wash my face in a truck stop bathroom. I'm gonna find a good job around here.
Michael Patrick F. Smith, The Good Hand, performing Truck Stop. Dakota Date Book is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Humanities North Dakota invites you to the virtual Game Changer Ideas Festival, January 14th through March 25th. Some of the nation's most respected thinkers from across the political spectrum present their solutions to critical issues facing our democracy today. The one-hour events start at 4 p.m. Central Time and are free and open to the public. More information and registration at humanitiesnd.org. The series continues February 18th with America Came Together a Century Ago, Can We Do It Again? With Shailen Rami Garrett, co-author of Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 16th. Edward Sheriff Curtis was born on this date in 1868 near Whitewater, Wisconsin. When he was in sixth grade, he built his own camera, changing his life forever. His family moved to Port Orchard, Washington in 1887 when he was 19. He kept pursuing photography and won a prestigious award for a photograph of Chief Seattle's daughter, Princess Angeline. In Montana, he witnessed a valley floor covered with thousands of teepees. At that moment, he decided to devote his life to recording the life of Native Americans and spent the next 30 years documenting over 80 tribes from the Mexican border to northern Alaska. His work struck a nice balance between portraits and everyday life. Three of those tribes were the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, the three affiliated tribes of North Dakota. One simple shot shows a Mandan earth lodge, which he noted is exactly like that of the Hidatsa. These shelters were thick, sturdy, and insulated, staying warm in the winter and cool in the summer. In Curtis's photo, you can see the densely packed dirt and support beams surrounding the mound. A bull boat leans against the square entrance. The picture provides a casual scene, something hard to explain in text. The bull boat was a significant part of the tribe's lives. A bowl-shaped wood frame was covered in buffalo skin with the fur facing out, sometimes with the tail still attached to pull it to shore. While slow and hard to steer, bull boats were light and could hold up to half a ton. Curtis captured two other pictures of bull boats. In one, the boat rests on a rocky shore of the Missouri River. In the other, we see a woman in a shawl paddling through the water. His portraits were also important. One of them is of Sitting Bear of the Arikara, the chief, when photographed in 1908. The image captures the chief wearing his full headdress along with an intricate leather jacket. It's the best-known photo of Sitting Bear. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, and in that case, the work of Edward S. Curtis is worth millions. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Florida hip-hop duo Black Violin really likes subverting expectations.
The number one reason I play the violin is because I'm not supposed to.
Now these classically trained musicians are searching for new outlets to share their art.
That's one of the things I miss the most, is just being able to perform for a live audience and be able to heal together.
They make a new song for us on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, an 8-year-old recently called out NPR for not doing enough dinosaur stories. He said instead of All Things Considered, it should be called Newsy Things Considered. Well, it cracked us up, and it got us thinking. It's about time for an update from the paleontology program at the North Dakota Geological Survey. And it so happens the summer fossil dig schedule was just finalized. We'll talk about fossils with state paleontologist Clint Boyd on Main Street on Wednesday. We hope you can join us. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.